This is a recording of Martin Cuthbert, 38 Castle Road, Rowland Castle, made on the 31st of March 2015.
Okay. Her name is Martin Cuthbert, 38 Castle Road, Rowland Castle, 59 years old. I was born 2nd and 3rd. 56. Well, my first memories of the village were obviously going to school with Miss Percy, who used to be the headmistress.
Where was the school?
At St John's, at the top of the hill, which is now the houses. And the where the school is now, that was our playing field.
Yeah.
A lot of the villagers that I grew up with, say a lot, some of the villagers that I grew up with are no longer with us. They passed away quite early in life, unfortunately. But school days were good fun. Most of the staff were from the village, especially the dinner ladies, like Miss Burt from Castle Road, Mrs. Goodall from Finchdean Road, and a couple of the others whose names I can't remember at the present moment, but I had a lot of friends in the village and enjoyed playing football, cricket in the park, obviously a recreation ground, I mean, golf on the course locally, always mooching around in the woods, and a bit of a country bumpkin. So, just going up to Stansted Lake, fishing, going into the Holt to do the same, do a little bit of fishing, the odd bit of ferreting and what have you.
Did you own any ferrets?
We had our own ferrets. We've always had a lot of animals in the family. Right from an early age, we had rabbits and budgies. Later on, we went on to finches and parakeets. At the present moment, I've got 4 parrots, plus a bit of poultry down the garden, which I enjoy. All my parrots are talkers, so it's quite funny in the evening sometimes. But always been animal orientated.
Yeah.
And
where
so
were you living at this time?
We lived in Castle Road at number 38.
Oh, really?
That's where I grew up.
So you're in the family house?
So I'm in the family house, yeah. When my mother died, my dad wanted to move out. And he moved into a rented house in Emsworth. And my childhood, I'm very close with my 2 brothers.
Are they younger?
Yeah, all younger. I'm the eldest. But Nick and Rob were exactly the same as me, very animal orientated, very much into the country scene. Always in Stansted, ferreting, and years ago when I used to walk home from a day's ferreting, say of a Saturday or a Sunday, people used to stop them in the village, take photographs of them and buy their rabbits from them. So they used to walk through the village with a pole and the rabbits strung between them. Yeah.
And did you eat the rabbits?
Yeah, we had our own, because we've always been that way inclined, you know, never anything, you don't just go out to kill anything, there's always been a purpose, whether it's for the pot or whether it's vermin or whatever that needs, But, very much enjoyed our childhood and whatever. And it's one of those things that we don't ever want to give up. I've been involved with Stansted since I was 8 years old. So I've been messing around in the woods for 51 years now.
You must know them better than anybody.
I know all the footpaths like the back of my hand, yeah. It's a lot of the old names are disappearing. When you mention, say, something like Ladies Walk or Pitt's Cops, locals nowadays don't know what you're talking about. Years ago, everybody knew each part of the forest. So, it was very interesting. But, when I first started working,
well, let's go back. After you left St John's, where did you go?
I went to Warblington.
Yes. Yeah.
Didn't enjoy that quite so much, although I got involved with the sports, athletics especially, a bit of rugby and football. But I was still very much the country bumpkin. I wanted to get out and be involved with the country, or I wanted to be a golfer, because I was all three of us are very good at golf.
Did you caddy at all?
I used to caddy a lot for the locals. I used to caddy for a Dr. News home from Emsworth, and on the odd occasion when he was in competition elsewhere, he would phone my parents and ask me if I was available, even on a school day, and of course I was available, because I enjoyed the caddying better than I did schooling. But
and what did he pay you?
Yes, he did. Yeah. We always got paid. But years ago, when we were kids in the village here, we used to go in the car park and wait for the golfers to come in, especially on competition days, and run up to them and ask them if they wanted a caddy or not. And most of the time, we had a bit of luck. So
when did this stop?
It sort of stopped when I started working.
Yeah.
But I still carried on playing golf, because one of my friends, Robert Bastable, was a greenkeeper on the course. Yeah. And then a few years later, he was made head greenkeeper. So he used to get us like a free round of golf. So we used to pal up and go round and enjoy an afternoon's golf every now and then. So
that was
very good.
Perks,
that was one of his perks. We always had. We'll say a lot of the locals, Martin Hargreaves, the Jerds, and the last one that I remember caddying for was, his name escapes me now. That's when I think he's passed away, actually. Left school.
Yeah.
Left Warblington School when I was 15. I had a few issues with certain people, and I didn't take any exams whatsoever. I didn't want to go back. So once that day came, I remember it quite well because I walked home and my mum was talking to the neighbour over the fence, and she said to the neighbour, "Oh, it was Martin's last day at school today," and I came walking down the alleyway between the two houses and I said, "Oh, thank Christ that's over." I had job interviews, one with the dockyard, one with the gas board. I got the one for the dockyard, but I didn't go. I was offered a job by Gilbert Ambrose, the butcher, in Westbourne, and I liked the idea of handling meat because basically they're just an offshoot from what I've been doing all my life, yeah. Cutting up rabbits and deer and etc. etc. He taught me the old-fashioned way of how to bone out meat and what have you, and we moved on from there because I wasn't sort of getting anywhere, as not working my way up the ladder, yeah. So to speak. Although he was teaching me a trade,
yeah.
When I went to Catherington Lane and worked for a chap by the name of John Grover, who was a bit of a Londoner, and he was surprised that I knew all the old-fashioned cuts.
He was a butcher too.
He was a butcher as well. I stayed in the trade for quite a few years, yeah. Working for various people. I did go back to Ambrose at one stage, but I stayed there and basically until he retired or became unwell just before he died. And then I was offered a position at Petersfield Abattoir as an inspector.
Oh, a meat inspector.
And worked there for a good number of years. And apart from working for myself, that was probably the best job that I ever had.
Where was the Abattoir in
Petersfield? Where Tesco's is now. The building in the front of Tesco's used to be the slaughterman's quarters, and all their families were living there because obviously they were the first people.
Yeah, in the morning.
In the morning,
yeah.
They used to start between 3 and 4 o'clock, depending on how much they had to kill that particular day. And our hours were 6 till 3.
How did you get up?
I just got up. I've always been an early riser, so it wasn't a problem.
Did you have a bike or train?
I know, I had my car.
Oh, you had a
car. Had a car then. And we used to, if we were short on work, we used to race through everything to get it all done, and they would let you go early, but they still paid you till 3 o'clock. But if it was busy, they expected you to stay until you were finished.
For the same money?
Well, no, because then it was overtime after sort of 3 o'clock in the afternoon. The odd occasion where we worked right through, just went home for a quick wash and a bite to eat and then went straight back. There was a time when we had 3 lorries set alight by animal rights people.
Yeah.
All the meat was destroyed with the vehicles.
Yeah.
And so their actions were counterproductive because we had to kill again in order to fulfill the orders. So we killed twice as much, and we just kept going until all the work was done. So we worked basically in 48 hours. Just quickly went home, had a quick wash, freshen up, and then back again.
Where did you get your input from, and where did they go out to the meat?
They had buyers that used to go to market, so they would buy in 2,000 lambs from one area, 2,000 from another, and so on and so forth. Same with the pigs, most of it was local, and the beef. We used to have buyers going out to some of the farms.
Yeah.
Or the farmers bringing cattle in, and so on and so forth. Used to come from all over the place, really.
Petersfield had a market at that time.
Petersfield had its own market. Guildford had a good market. But, and all these small markets now are slowly disappearing. They used to go to Salisbury. And get all their stuff from there. Used to have some really good quality meat, but you still can get good quality meat. But there's one, when I was working for Ambrose's, there used to be a lad there by the name, his nickname was Steptoe, because he acted a little bit like Harold Steptoe did. And he used to do all the rounds, all up Marden and Compton, where Pescott's butchers had Fred that went out in the van. The customers used to phone up Ambrose, and then they used to go and deliver to them, or give them an order. When you delivered one lot of meat, you was given an order for next week, and so on and so forth. And there used to be in West Marden Hall a major somebody or another. It was such a long time ago, I can't remember his name. But every so often he would have dinner parties, and everybody that was there were in like military dress. Evening, where they were dressed like black, red tunics, black trousers. And the women used to be in evening dress. And because I like drawing and I'm a little bit arty, they used to, every so often, they had like suckling pigs, and I used to have to do all the scoring. And on, as you, not just ordinary scoring where it's just straight lines, I had to draw like flowers in the skin, because when they're cooked, it all used to stand up like petals. So, it was quite good. I used to be in the cutting rooms, and you would find abscesses in a lamb's leg. So once they had split the animal down, because they used to do it in three. They used to take the legs off and the shoulders, and then it used to come to me to be looked at and make sure they trimmed it all properly and what have you, and then it used to go on to be vacuum packed or boxed up or whatever, and you just had to look for the signs, and I'd pull it aside and open it up and see what was what. Some of them were quite nasty, and you think, how on earth did they walk about without limping, you know? But all the other stuff like TB, we used to get the animals in that had TB for slaughter, and that used to go, the inspectors in the actual abattoir used to look out for those. I mean, they would be at the end of the day once everything else had gone through, and these animals would just basically put out their misery and dealt with accordingly. Years ago, one of the chaps that I shoot with, Alex Burden, he used to work on the local pig farms at Funtington and the odd place around where people may keep a dozen pigs or whatever. He used to do the inspections there for a TB. They would get a ministry vet come in, and if one animal had it, that animal was dealt with there and then on the farm, and just used to be taken off to like a flint quarry that used to be on the farm somewhere, and they just chuck them down the hole and then cover them up with straw and set them alight. Years ago, that's how it. Nowadays, it doesn't happen like that. Once an animal is found with TB, then the whole herd is quarantined straight away, and they can't move anything for weeks and weeks. It's completely different nowadays. But yeah, I mean, he used to go around and he used to do the castrating of all the male pigs and things like that. And years ago, nobody used anaesthetic or anything like that. You just turn them upside down, sort them out, and they were gone.
Yeah.
Just used to run around.
Yeah. Because they were so quick.
So quick.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
How long did you stay at the abattoir?
At the abattoir, I stayed there for about 10 years. It was. The things that they got up to was so funny sometimes. I used to get home in the evenings and I would cry with laughter trying to explain to my wife what they got up to that day. They were forevermore messing about, but they got their work done. So the governor just let it used to go over his head, you know, but yeah, they used to do some real funny stuff, but yeah, especially if it was your birthday.
Oh dear.
You were a fool if you went in there on your birthday. yeah, it was very. Yeah, it was a good place to work. It was a good laugh. Met some great chaps in there. And the money was good as well. And then unfortunately, they sold out to Tesco's. I mean, it used to be the flagship of British beef. We used to have a lot of foreign visitors when Lord Vesty was about, who owned the place. And they used to bring all the foreign dignitaries round. Petersfield was the place that they used to go. It was state-of-the-art slaughterhouse, yeah. And then they spent $2 million on the place, doing it up. And then 3 months later, they shut it down. We don't know really what the reason was. I know they sold out to Tesco for something like $6 million. When they started dismantling the place, they found the original, the walls of the original slaughterhouse that dated back to about 1500 and something. But that was lost once they built Tesco's. And the only part of the abattoir setup that is still there the old slaughterman's quarters, which I think now are offices. But one time they were empty for quite a few years and they were going into disrepair. And at that time, the council, the Petersfield Council, wouldn't let them do anything to them. But now I think they're officers. So times change.
They do. So then you have to find something else to do.
Yeah, I've been in engineering as well. I had worked for Britax Wingards in Chichester. Basically, I went there as a labourer. And then I got stuck into things that I shouldn't have been messing around with work-wise. But it was picked up by one of the supervisors. And they asked me if I was interested in doing machine setting, because they said you keep messing about with bits and bobs, and you know, are you keen to do that? I said, well, obviously I want to better myself. I don't want to stay a labourer all my life. So they offered me a couple of courses on machine setting. It was plastic injection moulding, and I got on with that. In the end, I was running the biggest department, and then I was one of the very, at the time, I was one of the very few that had a valid passport, and I was offered a job in Saarlouis in Germany for Britax to do their troubleshooting. There was a chap by the name of Doug Bond who was their troubleshooter at the time. Unfortunately, he went down with an incurable illness, and I can only assume that it was a cancer of some description. But he took me out to meet the various people that I needed to get involved with. I didn't speak any German or Spanish or anything like that, and fortunately the people that I had to meet did speak English, and got on like a house on fire with them all. The first person that I had to meet was Herr Wagner, who was an absolute monster of a man. He was built like Grizzly Adams. He weighed about 22 stone, but was just a big man. He wasn't fat or anything like that. Big bushy beard and what have it. And the first time that I met him, I was with Doug Bond, and he said, we'll have to go out this evening for a meal. He said, do you like chicken and chips and a little schnapps? Well, that's what I thought he said. It wasn't a little schnapps, it was a litre of schnapps. He had an appetite like an elephant. We went out for chicken and chips. It was a whole chicken in a basket of chips. He ate two of them.
No.
And of course I couldn't keep up with him with the schnapps, and I was under the table. I certainly had a rude awakening there. I mean, I'm not a drinker anyway, but I tried to keep up, and then I got halfway through and I thought I'd better not go any further. Well, I got on with him like a house on fire, and I'd done the troubleshooting for a number of years, going to Spain, Belgium, and whatever, sorting out their problems for them. I had, the last trip that I'd done was when they had the Hessel Stadium riot.
Yeah.
in Belgium where the fans were killed, about 80-odd fans. I had to go out to Belgium the Monday after that had happened. And the table that I had in my hotel, in the restaurant, was bang in the middle of the restaurant. And as soon as I spoke, they knew that I was an Englishman, and they just blanked me out completely. And I didn't get a very good reception in the Ford plant that I had to go to work. And I was glad to get out of there that time. That was the last time that I'd done that. That put me right off. I mean, the money was good. I was paid from the time I walked out my door to the time I walked back in. I paid 24 hours a day, all the time I was away from home. And the money was absolutely brilliant. But it was a lot of traveling, a lot of flying. Yeah. I love to fly, so I didn't mind going out. There was a time where I had to take parties of people with me to do like rework, and while I was calming the customer down, the chaps had to sort the work out on the site. And there was one incident where I took a chap out by the name of Barry Walford, who lived in Emsworth. And we took out some glass with us to replace the glass in some wing mirrors. And this time we drove from, we went to Dover, caught the ferry over to Ostend, drove through Belgium, and we had to then go on to, we'd done the work in Belgium, then we had to go on to Saarlouis in Germany. And because we were in an official works vehicle with the company logo in the window, we were just waved through at the checkpoint at the border. And I should have pulled over and gone in to the office to declare that I had glass and that with me. And of course, when we got to the Ford plant, we weren't allowed in because we never had the official paperwork. And then the next thing we knew, we were arrested for smuggling. We had like a solicitor with us. I mean, I knew that we were going to be all right.
Yeah.
But this
yeah.
Barry Walford was worried sick. He thought he was never going to see his family again. We spent the night in the local cells.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Then a solicitor was found for us, and they got in contact with Britax back here, and it was all sorted out via a telephone call. I felt such an idiot because I didn't stop at the border. I knew I had to do it, but because we were waved on, I said, yeah, go on Barry, carry on. And then it wasn't until we got there and I thought, oh no. But you learn, don't you? So.
And when did you stop doing
it? I stopped doing that. It wasn't long after the Hessel Stadium. I had a bit of a barney with the boss at Wingards. We did clash. We clashed on a number of occasions, solely through work. It was nothing personal. I told him what had to be done in order to make things better for the company. Because the customers were none too happy. We were the least preferred supplier. Yeah. And every time you that you got a complaint about your work, they knocked a point off. And we were down to like one or two points before we were losing the contracts. And I said, look, you've got to do it was all to do with the tooling. They were asking for modifications, and they wouldn't do it. And the next batch would go out, and again we'd have to go out and sort it all out for them. Because if they sent it back, they'd knock another point off. And we were the least preferred supplier, and I had quite a few barneys with him. In the end, I just walked out the door, and I got a job working for Hawker Engineering over in Hayling Island that made wind indicators for sailing boats. And the boss was married to a Chilean girl, so he used to disappear to Chile for 6 months at a time. And I used to run the place. It was only a small workshop with about a dozen workforce. They had a tool maker there that used to do brand new tools for people. And we used to run the machines basically 24 hours a day to build up stock. And because when the boss was back, he wouldn't build up stock. He would only make the stuff if to order. But if the customer was really busy and kept phoning up, he'd get fed up with them and tell them where to get off. He was given the business by his stepfather, and I don't think he really had his heart and soul in it, but he certainly had an attitude towards other people. But in the end, I left there, and that's when I started working for myself. So
what year was
it? That was about 19 years ago. So we're
94 and 96.
I mean, it was a nice little place to work at, and again the money was good, but a lot of pressure when we had to get the stuff out, because when I built up stock when he was away, it was just already there waiting to go, and the customers were really happy with that because they'd get it the following day. But as soon as he was back, it was back to his old ways again. You know, he just wouldn't carry anything. But, yeah.
And how did you set up working for yourself?
I had an insurance that I cashed in, which gave me enough to get the basic tools and vehicle, and we made up a lot of flyers, and I walked for 2 weeks putting flyers through people's doors in Rowlands, Emsworth and local district, Warblington, Havant, Horndene, and the phone never rang for 2 weeks, and I thought, have I made a mistake by trying to go out and work for myself or not? But the second Friday that I came home, Doreen, my wife, said to me that there's 4 phone calls for you, and out of those 4 phone calls, I've never looked back.
Can you Can you remember the names of your friends?
The first ones that phoned up was Mrs. Chalmers from Warblington, who I still work for, and Mrs. Guy from Warblington, who unfortunately passed away 15 years ago, but I'm still looking after the house. Her family is a really small family. All there is is a nephew who lives in Shrewsbury. When she passed away, she was buried in Warblington Cemetery, where her husband was there. I mean, it was a double plot. And when we went to the funeral, it was Doreen, my wife, and myself, the nephew, and the vicar. That's all there was. And I said to him, what do you want me to do? Do you want me to carry on sort of tidying up until you sell the place? Or what? And he goes, oh, well, I think I'll carry on with it, hold it for a little while. 15 years down the line, we're still looking after it. We cut the grass once a week, cut the hedges twice a year, but the rest of it is sort of all the beds are just brambles, all up against the windows, it's just brambles.
Is the house left?
No, the house hasn't been let. It's I went there one day and somebody had tried to break in through the front door. There was a lead light window in the front door and the bottom right hand corner had been stuffed in one day. I phoned the nephew. I told him that I'd notified the police. He said, oh, can you board it up and paint it the same colour as the door? So I said, yeah, I'll do that for you. He said, did they get in? I said, well, I don't think so, because obviously they couldn't undo the bolts top and bottom. And nothing else is damaged. So that's what we did. And 2 years ago, we're still looking after the property. And one day I went there to cut the grass, and it backs onto the railway line that runs to Emsworth. As I went down the garden towards the railway line, when I turned round to face the house, something didn't look quite right with the house. So I stopped the mower and investigated and found that the side of the conservatory had been taken off and was stacked up in neat little piles. There was a broken window. They had like still got crittle windows and crittle patio doors inside the conservatory leading into the sitting room. But one of the little panes of glass were broken. And I thought, oh no, I'll phone the police and let them know what's going on. So in actual fact, I couldn't get through on the phone, on my mobile, so I actually went round to Havant Police and reported it. And then I phoned the nephew and told him what had happened. And he said, well, I'll have to come down and see if anything's missing from the house. I think he had already taken the most valuable stuff out, like the silver and the nice bits of porcelain and whatever. They were already gone. So anyway, I'd reported it to the police and I said, look, I'm going to B&Q. I've got the board up the house, and they said, well, we need to send the CSI people round to check for fingerprints, etc., etc. So I said, okay, but I'm going to B&Q to get boards and that. So I said, if you want to get round here, you better get round there quick. When I went back to the house, there's an orange pushbike in the front garden. And I thought, well, that wasn't there earlier. So I left the van in the driveway so that nobody could get out. And I phoned the police again. And I said, look, I reported a break-in earlier. I think the person responsible is on site because I've just come back to board the place up. And I said, and there's an orange pushbike in the front garden. It wasn't there earlier. We're sending somebody round now. So they went, a young copper turned up. And he said, you wait at the front and I'll go round the back. And when he went round the back, he looked through the hole in the window, parted the curtains with his baton. And there's a chap in there sitting down eating fish and chips. Well, he said he was a squatter. Anyway, they came out together and he said he is known to us. And he goes, he said to me, look, I've been sleeping rough here. He said, I've been kicked out of the house and I'm sleeping rough. But he was too clean to be sleeping rough. Everything about him was spick and span. And what had happened was that he had obviously taken the side of the conservatory off, punched a hole through, and he actually found the key. He opened one of the windows, climbed in, and then found the key to those inner doors on the mantelpiece. And he said, I've been coming and going, you know, I've been living here. And I knew that he hadn't been living there. Anyway, they got in contact with the nephew. The officer got in contact. He said, what do you want me to do with him? Do you want me to arrest him? Because Martin thinks that he's broken in, but he's claiming that he's homeless and he's been living rough. Well, he said, and Chris, the nephew, said, oh, you know, if he's living rough, obviously he's fallen on hard times. Tell him he can stay in the caravan if he wants to, but not in the house. Now, I knew that he wouldn't stay in the caravan because the roof had caved in. And I spoke to Chris again. I said, Chris, he's broken in. And I have never ever been a key holder of the property. Never ever been a key holder. I wasn't interested in being a key holder. But anyway, the nephew came down and he said, I think you better have a key. I said, all right, fair enough. So he gave me a key. Anyway, I've never been in the place. He said, we'll have to get an alarm set up. I said, well, you'll have to arrange that, and, you know,